I'm Laura Danziger-Isakov. I'm here today to discuss with you on the topic of vaccines. And while vaccines is a very small topic and certainly can be covered in 10 minutes without a problem, I decided to focus rather than on listing all the vaccines that potentially could be used in this patient population for our transplant patients, rather to discuss the concepts and ideas that as an infectious disease professional and transplant infectious disease specific physician that I think about when I'm trying to determine which vaccines are right for my patients at what time and over the course of their arc of transplantation. So why don't we get started? Let's start with the first thing, which is the vaccines. The vaccines are a very important component, and understanding what types of vaccines are available is exceptionally important. So let's start with the types of vaccines that are available and the vaccination that we have, the vaccines that we have to consider when we're thinking about our transplant patients. So there are four basic types of vaccinations. There are toxoid vaccines like diphtheria and tetanus. There are subunit recombinant vaccines. So those are pieces of pathogens like hepatitis B and the new herpes zoster vaccine. There are inactivated vaccines like influenza. And then there are live attenuated vaccines like measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox. Each of those portend different risk to our patients and also have different probability of creating long-lasting immunity. And these are things that we have to consider with our patients when we're deciding which vaccines to give them. Additionally, some vaccines may or may not have adjuvant, which are designed to boost immune responses. And during this consideration, people have had concerns related to using adjuvants. As of now, there doesn't appear to be significant clinical risk to having adjuvanted vaccines for our transplant recipients. The next quality that we consider is how to give the vaccinations. So this certainly we can give vaccines orally, like rotavirus vaccine. We can also give vaccines through injections, either intradermally, subcutaneously, or intramuscularly. And these are things that we have to consider to make sure that vaccines are given correctly to our patients during the vaccination process. The next consideration that we have, really we focus more on the host in the next section. While the host is exceptionally important to realize, there are various things that we have to consider. The first thing that we have to consider is who we're vaccinating. So this can be related to the age of the vaccinee, the age of our transplant patient, whether they're a candidate or a recipient, or a family member that we're trying to boost so that we create a circle of immunity around them. Younger children, we have to consider how old they are. Are there timelines under which age they cannot receive a vaccine yet? So like a live viral vaccine before the age of 6 months due to potential interactions with maternal antibodies that were passively transferred or because the immune system is still maturing. Are the patients older, and do they need specific boosters related to their age? Are patients at an age where they can need to have a vaccine like a pneumococcal vaccine? Do they need an additional booster of their tetanus vaccine that includes pertussis because they haven't had that in their adult age? Or are they at high risk for reactivation of varicella? And do they need a shingles vaccine? All of these things need to be considered in the who the vaccinee is. Another population that has to be considered that when you're thinking about who is thinking about the underlying disease that the patient may have. If a patient has a disease that precludes them from getting vaccination, like for example, they're on high-level immunosuppression related to their underlying disease, and there are certain vaccines that wouldn't be recommended in the pre-transplant period, you have to consider that. You also need to consider if they're likely to respond to their vaccine. There are certain underlying disease conditions that predispose patients to having poor responses to their vaccinations. It doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't vaccinate them, but it may mean that you need to give them a different dose or on a different time schedule. An example of this is patients with end-stage renal disease who are on dialysis, who may respond more poorly to their hepatitis B vaccine. And in this circumstance, you would want to give them an an increased dose or the dialysis dose of hepatitis B vaccine. Additionally, you may need to give them more than one series. So when we're thinking about the host and we think about who they are, we think about not only how old they are, where they are in the spectrum of their age and what is recommended. And I'm not going to give you all of those specifics because those change over time. Those are things that are different, and you need to monitor those to see what new vaccines are coming and what other things are available to your patients. But you have to think about the age, how quickly you can get the vaccines to them, what they need, as well as their underlying illness and them coming to transplant. The next thing that we think about is the when. And this is a significant question. Where are your patients in the arc of their transplant journey? Are they very early in the transplant process, even before they have end-stage organ disease? Do you have an opportunity to vaccinate them before they become substantially ill enough that vaccine may have less opportunity to vaccinate your patients? Are your patients in the pre-transplant assessment where they're seeing your team regularly, or that they're being evaluated by clinicians regularly? Do you have the opportunity to work with those people to make sure that the patient is getting their scheduled vaccines appropriately? For pediatric patients, it's exceptionally important to work with the primary care providers who are providing routine vaccines, as well as to think about how old a patient is and where they are in the spectrum of urgency for transplant, to think about if you can accelerate vaccination. Certainly, related to the vaccine type and where they are in the phase of transplantation, this is the opportunity before transplantation to provide most live attenuated viral vaccines like measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella. Clearly, we don't want to put a patient at risk for having these illnesses if we can avoid it. And if we can do that before they're on substantial immunosuppression in the post-transplant period and provide a window at least around 3 to 4 weeks after a live viral vaccine before anticipated listing or transplant, that gives you the chance to avoid some of the complications that we're going to talk about in a few minutes. So if a patient has now progressed through for the pre-transplant phase and is at the time of transplantation, that's generally not a time when we're thinking about actively immunizing a patient. And we'll talk about some of those reasons when we get to the mitigating factors. But in the post-transplant period, there's certainly the opportunity to reinitiate vaccination in these patients who are either incompletely vaccinated or reach certain stages of their life or have certain events that require them or necessitate them to get more or different vaccines. This is especially true in the post-transplant period when patients start to feel better and may want to do travel or things like that. So that's an important opportunity for us to intervene in the post-transplant period. So now that we've talked about the time course of your patient as a when, either pre-transplant or post-transplant as a factor that you're going to consider when you're talking about immunizing your patient, the next thing that I wanted to discuss are the mitigating factors that can affect your decision to immunize your patient. So many of these factors are things that may be either planned out in advance, or they may be things that happen over the course of the transplant that affect the potential response to vaccination. The first thing that everyone will know in advance is the type of transplant that the patient's going to receive. This may affect the likelihood based on their underlying illness for their response to vaccination, or there may be other mitigating risks. One of the risks may be the presence of pre-existing antibodies in your patient and the desire to do pre-transplant desensitization. Now, this is a varied process. There's lots of different protocols, but many of them affect the arms of the immune system that specifically will allow for vaccine responses. So if patients are planning to get proteasome inhibitors, they're planning to get B-cell depleters, they're planning to get plasmapheresis or immunoglobulin replacement on a routine basis, that may not be the ideal time to start the introduction of vaccination. Ideally, vaccination would be performed prior to planned desensitization, early in the pre-transplant period. But if that isn't the case, and you need to be a little bit more flexible, getting the patient as up to date as possible, moving them through the desensitization process, and remembering and marking the patient's chart and reminding the patient that there are vaccines that are still necessary is exceptionally important. There may be other medications that are used in induction that can specifically affect the timing of post-transplant of the vaccines that you may want to consider giving. Patients may be planned to receive T-cell depleters or B-cell depleters or both in that case, and this may affect the time to recovery of B-cells and T-cells in the post-transplant period when you would expect vaccine response to return and be effective. This may have been shown to be a case in the influenza vaccine, where the influenza season is cyclical, and patients may be transplanted throughout the year, obviously, and may be transplanted in the middle of a flu season before or even after they've had the opportunity to have an influenza vaccine. When to give them their vaccine in that period afterward is very important to consider. What type of induction they've had, so that you can consider whether or not you need to do an alternative strategy. And there have been some strategies that have been shown in the influenza to boost responses, including high-dose vaccine in solid organ transplant recipients, as well as doing booster doses, more than one dose of influenza vaccine in a season. So depending on the period of time peritransplant and what the patient experiences, that's something to strongly consider. Another thing to consider in induction is whether or not you anticipate the patient will need a complement depleter or a complement interrupter. And I think that's, if you plan on giving your patient something like eculizumab, there are specific vaccines against pneumococcus as well as meningococcus that are strongly recommended, in addition to and not supplanting the administration of prophylactic antibiotics. But if you plan that in advance, those can be given pre-transplant, even if that is something that's a strong consideration in a patient's transplant plan. Or if they happen to get them in the post-transplant, that drug in the post-transplant period, those vaccines can be given. They may, but you will have to also give prophylactic antimicrobials. The next thing that may happen to your patient outside of induction is an event of rejection, either acute cellular rejection or acute antibody-mediated rejection. Both of these things will affect the immune system. Both of the treatment of these will affect the immune system and the ability to respond to vaccination. Maybe the vaccine needs to be, routine vaccines need to be delayed during this period, but this is also a consideration and should be a conversation when the patient has planned vaccination during that period. For the last mitigating factor that I want to talk about are exposures. These either can be anticipated with something like travel, or unanticipated, such as a child who goes to school and gets exposed to the chickenpox. Understanding what the immunization status of the patient is very important in both of those circumstances. For travel, it can affect the type of vaccine you may give, especially for someone, let's say, who goes to a typhoid endemic area, where it would be preferable and recommended that the patient receive an injectable typhoid vaccine, which is inactivated, rather than a live attenuated vaccine orally. For the child who becomes exposed to chickenpox, there are interventions that may be helpful to help prevent the child who may not have been vaccinated previously because they were too young to be vaccinated when they received their transplant. Or they haven't had a response to their vaccine and they need an intervention. So knowing what those exposures are and whether or not there's vaccine that can be provided. Certainly for young children who are transplanted at a very young age who may not have received their live viral vaccines, there's ongoing research to indicate that it may be safe in very certain circumstances, including very low-dose immunosuppression several years after transplantation, to provide those live attenuated viral vaccines, although this is an ongoing area of research and cannot be recommended to everyone at this point in time. The last thing that's really important when we're talking about vaccination, it's very important to think about what type you're giving, how you're giving it, who you're giving it to, when you're giving it, where the patient is in the course, and what other types of things have happened to the patient that's going to affect their response. But for many of the vaccines, it's really important to measure their response and to know whether or not they've had an appropriate seroconversion and that you can expect that should they get exposed, that they will be protected. So it's suggested by the American Society of Transplantation in the ID Community of Practice guidelines that certain vaccines have serologic response measured to ensure that patients are safely protected. And I would suggest looking in the pre-transplant and post-transplant phase at both of the charts that are available online so that you can see what serologies would be helpful for your patients to have. So in conclusion, I hope we've had a little conversation about how to take care of our patients and how to think about vaccination in terms of both the vaccines that we have available to us, without naming them all, because those are all available in the ID Community of Practice AST guidelines, but also to think about the vaccines and the host, the patients, our patients, and how each unique patient needs to be addressed based on the factors that they present with. What is their underlying disease? How old are they? Where are they in the spectrum of their transplant journey? What other things have happened to them? What is their anticipated course? What are the things that we plan to do to them? And then how to take care of them when bumps occur along the way so that we can make sure that we're doing everything we can to have a healthy outcome for all of our patients. Thank you.